Welcome to the Hometown Hero Outdoors Podcast. Here is your host, Chris Tatro.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Hometown Hero Outdoors Podcast. Today, we have an awesome guest named Laura Shera. Laura Shera was our MC for our annual banquet last year here in St. Paul, Minnesota. Laura is a host on Minnesota Bound. I'm sure many of you in the Midwest have seen the show, but for our listeners who have not, you need to look up Laura in the show. They have a longevity of a very long show that it stems way back many years, and Laura's now the host of it. So, Laura, thank you very much for being on the podcast with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, not a problem. So it's been a pretty busy fall, and I know you just got back from doing another podcast. So if you want to introduce yourself to the listeners and whatnot, you could let them know who you are, you know, what your life looks like, what shows you do, and what other stuff you're involved in within your career.
Sure. My name is Laura Shera, as Chris had mentioned, and I co-host a television show on Care 11 NBC called Minnesota Bound, and my dad, Ron Shera, started the show 27 years ago. So it is a outdoor lifestyle show. So we are in the business of storytelling. So our passion is to share the stories of others and how they're passionate about the outdoors, from hunting, fishing, canoeing, hiking, habitat and wildlife conservation, to organizations like Hometown Hero Outdoors and what they're doing to bring people outdoors. We really are in the business of sharing other people's stories and passions. And that is truly what makes my job so fun. But I think that has been the success to the longevity of the show, is that inevitably, all of us are storytellers in some way or another. And I have said it's really in our DNA. And if you think back to caveman days, they were writing their stories on rock walls. And everybody loves to share their story. So I feel really blessed to be able to co-host the show today with Bill Shirk. And my dad still does segments on the show, and so does Travis Frank. And we are continuing the legacy of outdoor storytelling. So it's been really fun. And I have, before getting into outdoor television, I was in the fashion industry. So I graduated with a fashion degree and was working for Target Corporation / Marshall Field's department stores. If you're from Minnesota or Chicago, you know of those. And then Macy's eventually bought Marshall Field's division. So I was working for Macy's Corporation, producing fashion shows and doing fashion television for many years. And I was traveling the country doing that. And then I approached my dad at a young age, asking him if I could do some outdoor segments of things to do in the outdoors, right kind of in the metro area. And I presented this segment called Wild in the City. And he said he would give it a shot. And I always joke that he said it was on a volunteer basis. So I was doing a lot of volunteer work over a lot of years. And I continued to do those segments on the side. So I had a full-time job for many, many years before I transitioned full-time into outdoor television. And in fact, my first big contract was with North American Fisherman and North American Hunter on NBC Sports. And when that was presented to me, I decided to leave my fashion career full time and go into outdoor television full time. So I had that. And then I eventually started getting paid for my time on Minnesota Bound. And I was doing some stuff on a show called Due North Outdoors, which is on Fox Sports North. And that's what kicked off my official outdoor television career. And since then, I've had the blessing of working for the Outdoor Channel and doing other television opportunities with travel, including Fun Jet Vacations. I was working for Lifetime Fitness, doing some health and fitness television and things like that. So it's been a really fun ride. And I feel really blessed that I've been able to do some really unique and fun things for work.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, you've been immersed in a lot of different things over the years. It's pretty awesome. You know, wide variety, not only from being out the outdoors, but the fashion side of things. Where did you go to school?
I went to college in Madison, Wisconsin. So I'm a Badger. And okay. I
we'll hold that there. Against you.
I know. A lot of people, if I ever posted that on social media, I get half of it's like love and half of it's hate, of course.
Right. That border battle, but it's all love.
Exactly. Big border battle. But I, you know, I'm still a Twins and Vikings fan and Timberwolves. I'm actually going to the Timberwolves game tonight. So I love Minnesota sports. And, but yeah, so I have always been, even growing up, I was, this fashion girl, yet my dad was this outdoor person. So my sister and I tagged along a lot on some of his adventures. And, so that's, you know, my mom was more of a, she wasn't quite outdoorsy. She grew up on a farm in North Dakota and she was a singer and, was kind of a fashionista. She was an actress and a singer. So, you know, I was always raiding her closet for fashion when I was a young girl. So I kind of got the fashion side from her. And then I had this outdoor side from my dad. And I still live my life like that very much. I still today I produce runway fashion shows for the Mall of America. And it's a very large show. We just we fly in designers from the TV show Project Runway, but I'm in charge of producing the whole thing from music to video to models to the choreography to calling the show and doing all the things. Wow. And that takes, you know, 6 to 9 months of planning. And now it's growing. We just did the show at their New Jersey, New York location this year and also the Mall of America. So that takes up another big chunk of my time. So I have that fashion side I'm still involved in. And I love the fact that I get back outdoors because that's probably my most soothing place to be. And it's a really good balance for
me. That's pretty cool. Yeah. So it sounds like you got a pretty good mix of both your parents and your life growing up with the fashion side and the outdoor industry. So that's pretty cool to be able to bring both of those experiences and what's the word I'm looking for? Passions. And be able to mix them in together. So you get to be in both of those worlds at the same time. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so, I enjoyed it.
No, sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you there. So from a young age, you're in the closets looking at, you know, your, the fashion stuff, you know, with your mom's side of stuff. And then you got your dad in the outdoor industry. So 27 years ago, you said the show began with Minnesota Bound, right?
Yes.
So what was that like growing up, you know, having your dad producing TV shows and telling stories? I mean, were you in some of these shows growing up at all? Were you helping give ideas or were you taking along on these trips? Like, what was that like?
Sure. Growing up with my dad was a writer for the Minneapolis Star and Tribune for many years before he started the television show Minnesota Bound. And he was on another show locally called PM Magazine, I believe. And that show was like a local entertainment show. And he used to do segments for that. So I remember as a young girl that there would be cameras at the house and they would be filming some outdoor segments. And my mom being in a lot of commercials growing up. So there's a lot of just growing up around the world of doing television. And when my dad decided to start Minnesota Bound, he kind of started realizing people were watching TV more than they were reading paper newspapers. So that's where he got the idea of taking his writing. And that really is, you know, one of my dad's gifts is his writing ability. And that, in my belief, is one of the reasons Minnesota Bound has had such success and is so successful is a lot due to my dad's ability to write really amazing stories about other people and adventures and things and how he puts his words together. So he's been a really big mentor of mine, of course, in learning how to really dial in my own writing for the show. So we're all responsible for writing our own stories. So my dad writes his, Bill Shirk writes his, I write my own, and Travis does the same. And that's a very much a learned skill. So there's a, I'm kind of going off tangent here, but so going back to before Minnesota Bound was started, you know, our childhood for my sister and I was very much about, you know, we'd follow our dad around everywhere. I was a total tomboy growing up. My sister and I both got into riding horses. We were doing barrel racing. I'd follow my dad around in cowboy boots and jeans. I refused to wear a skirt to school or any sort of dresses. I was just like this girl outside all day long. And my sister was the same. And my dad had wild turkeys as pets growing up. So he did that. My dad's very passionate about wild turkey hunting. And the wild turkey population, specifically in Minnesota, was diminishing quite a bit. So he was using these wild turkeys as educational pets. So he would give talks. And when he was doing public speaking and things like that, he would talk about wild turkeys and the importance of wild turkeys. And he actually was had a fundamental part of getting the National Wild Turkey Federation here in Minnesota and actually getting the turkey population to what it is today. And as you know, there's wild turkeys everywhere now.
Everywhere.
So you can either blame my dad for that or you can thank him, whatever, however you feel.
Hey, I think it's great. I love yeah. turkey hunting. It's my number one thing.
It is a lot of fun, isn't it? So growing up with wild turkeys as pets were, you know, tom turkeys, as you know, are pretty aggressive at times, and they would chase my sister and I down in a very, it felt like violent manner, though we were never injured, but of course they would scare us to death. And he would also buy baby mallard ducks, and we would raise them in our garage, and we'd bring them, my mom would let us bring them in the house, and we put them in the bathtub, and then we would release them on our pond that we lived at, and eventually those birds of course would migrate away, but they would come back to have their babies. So they would migrate back to our pond. And so we were always about learning about wildlife. My dad, you know, anytime we were out, you felt like you're on an encyclopedia walk, you know, he would see a raccoon and tell you a unique fact about raccoons. And he still does that today. And so that we really learned about the circle of life very young. We were around, you know, pheasant hunting very young, following my dad in the field. We were told to help clean pheasants, you know, at a young age, or learn how to do those things and really getting your hands dirty. My sister and I, you know, our chores were cleaning dog kennels and making sure they had water and really participating in all the things that surround kind of the outdoor world. And today I thank my dad for that. I think in my younger years, especially in my teens where I was into horses and I was doing some cheerleading and, you know, all of those things and chasing boys and all that, I kind of got out of, I wasn't really interested in any of that. And now that as I've gotten older, I definitely have become much more passionate about spending time in the outdoors. And you really see the value of what nature can do if it's from hunting, fishing, hiking, canoeing, sitting under a tree, listening to birds in the morning, what that can do for your mental health and wellness, just by resetting your central nervous system in a way, it's pretty incredible. So today I'm a huge advocate of outdoors, anything, you know, it doesn't have to be just hunting or fishing, anything you can do to connect yourself, to immerse yourself back into nature. And of course, the more extreme of an adventure you go on into the wilderness, you then almost become it. You know, if you're going elk hunting or if you're, I went on a horse packing trip that was days in the middle of nowhere at 10,000 feet in Wyoming. Like, you are immersed to nature. Your phone does not work. You really don't have any idea what time it is, nor do you care. Your body clock goes off of kind of the sunrise and the sunset, and you feel the most at ease you've ever felt in your entire life.
That so, fresh, clean, crisp air up there, yeah.
And when you take that in, you realize, like, this is a gift and we all need to really protect it and also take advantage of it in a respectful way. You know, don't leave our footprints there, you know, make sure that we leave it the same way we showed up. It's left the same way. So that's, you know, I think what the gift that my dad passed on to me is just appreciating the outdoors the way it should be appreciated.
Getting back to our roots, you know, all the things 100%. That,
your ancestral society's
grown away from. Yeah.
Yeah. And even your instincts become really heightened when you're out in the outdoors. If you're sitting in a, you know, sitting next to a tree hunting turkeys, or if you're sitting in a deer stand, like, your hearing can become more acute, your sense of smell, all the things that you kind of blindly don't even think about when you're in your everyday life, all of a sudden become awakened when you're outdoors. And those instinctual sharpening, when you sharpen your instincts, a lot of that comes in handy in your everyday life, from making business decisions to because you learn to listen to your gut instinct, and your gut instinct is actually almost always accurate. And when you get a feeling and you know what that feeling is, when you sharpen it, I feel like it gets really sharpened when you're in the outdoors too. It is very valuable in everyday life. And I feel like you can get so surrounded by social media and your phone and instant gratification with everything we do, from food to, you know, our technology and things like that, that all of those natural instincts that we have can become really dull. So anyway, there's just endless gifts that are given to us from the outdoors.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, and I think a lot of our younger generation too, that is moving up, you know, I mean, our world, when we were kids, you and I mean, I think we're similar in age, but when we were young in that cell phone era was not there.
No,
I think being outside and having that connection to the outdoors with our day-to-day life and just being outdoors every day, essentially, was because we didn't have that other entertainment there. I mean, there was like playing video games at Nintendo or Xbox back then, but not like today's day and age. Everyone's got a mini computer in their hand, you know, and these younger generations will never know what it was like to not. And experiencing the outdoors at a younger age was hopefully not something that's going to go to the wayside for children in the future, but unfortunately it probably is, you know. So our upbringing from our generation, I think, has been pretty fortunate to have that and understand that and continue to carry that. It's just passing that along to the next generation, which I just took my kids deer hunting this last week in Wisconsin for firearms opener. And they're different kids, you know, getting them out in the deer stand, having them sit there and look out the window and not stare at their phone the whole time. It's unbelievable just to see how they interact with the outdoors and things that they haven't experienced, and really understanding that, hey, I enjoy this. I like being out here. I like being able to hunt and spend time together in a different way than we normally traditionally would, which is pretty rewarding. So it was a lot of fun, you know, and it's a whole nother world now.
Very much so. And you start seeing reports too of, the amount of depression increasing in younger children, and all the negative things that come along with depression and insecurity. And you're seeing, unfortunately, you know, suicides increasing, et cetera. And, you know, I feel that there is, as much as, you know, when they say exercise and all of those things can help is a cure for depression, which I believe it is, I also feel that the outdoors is another place where that is a free medication, if you will, on happiness and joy. And part of that comes from being able to conquer things that are challenging and difficult. And when you're in the outdoors, it teaches you that not everything's going to go your way all the time. It teaches you how to deal with failure and loss when you lose the trophy fish at the end of your line. If you're dealing with weather, I was just out pheasant hunting this weekend. It was 15 degrees and 20 mile an hour winds. It was cold. And on my ride there, I was thinking, this is going to be a bitch. Excuse my language, but I was like, this is horrendous. And I realized once I was out there and I was moving, at times my fingers are cold. And of course, it's harder to shoot when you're all wrapped up in all this stuff and everything else. But at the same time, it was such a fun day. And those are the moments that leave you with feeling moments of joy and happiness. And a lot of times it has to deal with things that are challenge you the most. And that there's a lot of studies that have been done too on how our bodies and our DNA are really have been, we do best in having adversity and challenges in our life. And when we don't, with as far as think about it, how we get our food, if there's no challenge in getting our food anymore, there's no challenge in connecting with people anymore, because we seem to be doing this through a tech, through a device versus each other. A lot of our, you know, our what I call microwave society, it's this instant gratification that we have with everything at this point, I think is actually making a lot of people unhappy, and they don't even know it until you put yourself into situations that are challenging. And it can go from anything from going to the gym and having to do heavy weights, or whatever your challenge is for yourself, and be able to accomplish that without quitting is, and the same thing with the outdoors, when you have to go hike a lot of miles to get to a spot where you may or may not have success out in the field. Those things are so beneficial to you. And that's why it's important to get kids out there doing those things. And it doesn't have to be, you know, you don't take your kid to go climb Mount Everest, but getting them to fish for sunnies and, you know, being able to actually take the sunny off the hook and all of those things that might be scary at first, or those things are so helpful as you get into adulthood, and you need to continue those things into adulthood and putting yourself into challenges. If it's mentally challenging, physically challenging, whatever it is, that is one part of bringing joy, believe it or not, are things that are really hard.
Oh, totally. Yeah, that was a really good point too, you know, about, you know, the disappointment side of things. You know, when you go hunting and fishing, it's not always about harvesting that animal. I mean, you would like to, you know, but it's not practical or necessarily accurate to say that every time you go out there, you're going to get your trophy animal. I mean, it's my son was his first time at 13 hunting out there, you know, and he saw the first two doe coming this last weekend and he was scared. You know, I get that, you know, like he had to come over that hurdle about taking a deer, you know, and do I want to harvest this, you know, the gun, the firearm, you know, is it going to be loud? Is it going to hurt my shoulder? What happens if I miss the deer? What if I injure it? I mean, all these things are running through his head, but those are good, I think, things for our youth to work through in their life because it helps decision-making overall. And at the end of the weekend, I asked him, I said, did you have fun this weekend? Or do you regret not taking a deer? He says, well, I'm bummed I didn't take a deer, but I'm ready. And because he was able to process all these different things now and sit and think about it. And then also we harvested a couple other deer and he saw that it wasn't something that hurt them or anything like that. You know, there were clean harvests and how we took care of the animals and prepared it and being able to stand there and watch the process and cleaning the animals. I think it was very eye-opening to my son to be able to say, I can do this. And the decision process, you know, and working through that, I think will help out in the long run when it comes to other decisions they have to make.
Of course. It's also it's great to have a connection to understand where food comes from, because as we go into grocery stores and obviously things are wrapped in and are very clean and we just choose to go have what we call a steak or a chicken breast or things like that. And there, it's good to have a connection to understand of where food comes from and the circle of life and have respect for that. And, you know, it's interesting too, that we, even how we, you know, when we're harvesting deer or turkey or what have you, how we even name it in the grocery store, we call it filet mignon. It's versus like, this is a muscle of a cow, you know?
Right.
And
yeah.
There's purposely a disconnection of where food comes from. And, I think it's good. You have a better understanding of the circle of life. You actually have more gratitude towards food on your table. You understand the work it takes to get it. You know, you can go hunting for one turkey. That's probably maybe one or two meals tops. And you could be out there 12 hours to get one. And you're like, wow, that's, you know, so you might have a better appreciation for even for farmers and, you know, all the hard work that goes into putting food on our table. So it is, all of those things are really good for, in my opinion, anybody to participate in and to have an understanding that it's the circle of life. That one thing dies to feed another. And that happens with mushrooms and saturating soils and everything else. So,
I mean, it's the cleanest type of food that you can get. I mean, it's all, you know, there's no antibiotics or chemicals introduced, you know, with the wild game. And then like my son, all my kids really like to eat our venison jerky, you know, and now they've seen where it starts, you know, and the next step now is once, you know, we cleaned our deer and now that we have it in the freezer, we're going to start making that jerky next. And that's something that they're going to be involved in, you know, because someday, you know, I feel like that is something that they're going to enjoy themselves on their own, but also, you know, in the event that something happens, I'm not trying to be a conspiracy theorist or whatever, but you know, when it comes down to your roots, you know, they're able to know how to harvest an animal and get it to the plate and feed your family if needed.
That's true. And those things are important. It's important to, you know, as time moves forward, you're able to harvest your own organic food source, grass-fed food source, a very healthy, food source. And that for your own health is important decision-making when you have the skill to go do that. You know, it's a good skill to have for sure.
Totally. So when it comes to the shows you've done or even personal trips, I know you have done some various ones. I know you, with your shows, you've gone all over the place and been able to film some pretty incredible stories and, even some personal experiences. I know you went on a sturgeon trip recently too. Is that right?
Yeah, I did this summer.
Was that a personal?
It was personal. Yes, no cameras along except my iPhone. Yes, I have a thing for chasing trophy fish. I don't know what it is. I you know, walleye fishing, as much as I love to eat walleye, I don't find it as entertaining as bass fishing or musky fishing. I feel like that's anti-Minnesota. I don't mean to say that, but any day I would prefer to chase and catch and release trophy fish. I find it as just a lot of fun. So I've always wanted to catch a sturgeon. And when I started reading about sturgeon, and my boyfriend Dan and I have a home in Bellevue, Washington, which is just outside of Seattle.
Oh, beautiful.
And yes, it is beautiful. The state of Washington, if you have not been or it's been a while, is one of the most beautiful states in our country. I mean, totally. The topography of Washington is incredible. It gets a bad rap because everybody says it rains there all the time, but it really doesn't rain all the time. You might get a little mist here and there, and some might come out in the afternoon. But if you look at the weather map, it looks like you have rain every day. It's not necessarily like that. However, if you go from the months, I would say right after July 4th, they always say July 4th is 50-50 in Seattle, Washington. And then July 5th, you got sun every day until mid-September. And the weather there is low humidity. It's nice and cool in the morning. It's warm in the afternoon, and there's zero rain. So go to Washington after July 5th is my tip of the day. But the hiking there, the fishing, the salmon fishing, but they have a lot of areas that you can fish for white sturgeon, and they're huge. And I found a guide that is right. He's actually in British Columbia, Canada. And that trip from Seattle is actually only 3 hours. So I hired him for the day. His name is Yves Bissonnette. And he has been guiding for 20 some years on the Fraser River. And the Fraser River is known for white sturgeon. And white sturgeon are a prehistoric fish. And in fact, many of them will live up to 150 years old in this river system. And they don't even start spawning until the age of 15 or 20. So any fish, you know, you catch is going to be an old one. And I can't remember exactly how many years passed they started microchipping the white sturgeon on behalf of conservation efforts. So for a while back, I don't know if it was in the 80s or early 90s, the numbers of white sturgeon were starting to dwindle. And it really is due to fishing guides that have volunteered on behalf of collecting data for the government that they would microchip these fish in their fin, a little tiny fish, a little tiny microchip, when they catch one. And so now, anytime you catch a white sturgeon, you're not allowed to bring it out of the water at all. And they all have these scanners. Well, they'll scan the fish for a microchip and they document it. And they can now tell A, how old these fish are, B, how many times they're caught a year. And they've been able to track some of these fish. And so the first sturgeon that I caught was 6 feet long. In my eyes, I thought it was like huge.
20 feet.
Yeah. And he's like, oh, this one's not that big. I was like, it's over 6 feet. And then reeling that in, you know, the day we went on the Fraser River, the water was, I think, 20 feet high or something. The river was running like white rapids. I have never seen a river run fast in my life. In fact, I was like, I don't know how. I pulled up to the river. I'm like, there's no way we're going to be able to fish this today. I mean, It was just like, whoa. And you know, he has so much experience that he knew of kind of little spots where it was kind of a bend in the river that was not going so fast. And we tucked in over there, but caught the first fish, scanned it. And my dog is over here.
Bacon?
Yes, for a squeaky ball. Of course.
Cater to the
pump. Yeah, I ate my dog. Anyway, he microchipped it, and that fish was 20-some years old. Wow. And we released it right away. And these fish, when you look at them up close, their skulls are actually hard, like human skulls. When you knock on the skull of the fish, it's like rock solid. And they have this beautiful pattern on their and the skin is almost like shark skin in a way. It's not like scaled. And it has this beautiful like snowflake pattern on it. And they have bright blue eyes. And they have these barbs all the way down their spine that I think are like literally left over from prehistoric days. Either way. So I released the 6 foot fish, went back out, and Dan, my boyfriend, caught a monster, and he fought this thing for 40 minutes. And
wow.
When you're fighting a 250, 300 pound fish in water that's flowing as fast as that river was, I mean, it's like a battle.
That's a workout. Sure enough,
and at first you think you just keep, you know, you pull up, reel down, pull up, reel down, and you almost think you're going to win. And the fish gets runs. Close to the boat and it just runs and you're all over again. So
that's battling the best, but also the worst.
No, you like everything's burning, all your muscles, the lactic acid is building in your muscle. I mean, everything's on fire. So regardless, that one ends up getting off the hook as soon as we got it close to the boat 30 minutes later. So we lost that one, which is a bummer because that was a big fish. And then it was my turn again, and I hooked on to a monster. And again, that was another 30-minute ordeal. At one point, we had to trade off and on because you just burn out. I mean, you're everything in your body. You have nothing left to reel this fish in. So Dan would take a turn. I would take a turn. And sure enough, we got it close to the boat where she was tired. And I was able to hop into the river. We pulled way over underneath this bridge, and I was able to get out of the water, both of us, and take a picture with this fish. She was well over 8 feet, 8 foot.
Wow.
Long, and well over 250 pounds. And the best part was releasing it, just seeing her just swim right back up so calmly. And that was like that. Was incredibly wild. I've never, and they'll come out of the water. They'll jump out of the water, and it was a fight of a lifetime. But it was so fun just to see the conservation effort behind the fish. Now they're super healthy populations. The fish had zero damage to it whatsoever, and she just swimmed right away.
Are they using circle hooks and stuff like that?
Yes, they are using circle hooks, and then they'll use some chunks of like rotten salmon actually they're obviously sturgeon or bottom feeder, so that is how you fish for white sturgeon. But they're big, and he's an incredible guide. He's a lot of fun.
What's his name? Do you got it off the top of your head?
Yes, his name's Eve Bissonette.
Okay.
And so for our listeners, yes, if you want to book a trip with him, you got to do it way in advance because he's so busy. I think he guides like literally 365 days a year. Let me look.
Did he ever mention anything about issues with people and illegal harvests with the sturgeon out there? I know, they're a huge carrier of caviar and whatnot. So I know, sometimes there's some issues with people poaching the caviar and killing the animals.
Yeah, no, where he is at, the government, they are, and also the guides there, are very passionate about conservation. Like that is their number one thing over any, that is first. And so he didn't mention any of that. I did do a Minnesota Bound podcast. I interviewed him. So we went into detail about the conservation effort that he's involved in with the Canadian government, but that was not brought up during our conversation of illegal harvesting or poaching. From my knowledge, I'm sure there are cases of that, unfortunately.
Right.
It has not, the population of white sturgeon in British Columbia is very healthy right now.
That's good. And for our listeners.
Guides.
Sorry about that. I interrupted you.
Oh, that's okay.
So our listeners, just so you know, too, like I was talking about the sturgeon and the caviar, a large amount of the caviar that is used in the market is from sturgeon that is farm raised. They're able to actually get a way to harvest those eggs humanely with these fish. But then there's also people out there who are seeking it since the price is so high for how much this caviar costs. They will illegally take it from a fish, but usually the fish does not make it in the long run because they have to cut it open. So it's obviously not humane and not good for them. So,
I don't think caviar is good. I mean, I know some people love it. I'm not a fan, but
there's a huge market for it, and it's not cheap. Obviously they're coming from very old fish.
Yeah,
who would have thought, though? Maybe right,
something else on a cracker.
And a lot of the commercialization of fish and game, there's some big money in that. People be surprised with some of the costs or the money that's involved with purchases of some stuff, to include things such as minnows or even spruce tops or birch poles. I mean, there's a lot of money that people can make off that resource. And so if it gets overused, you know, it can really be detrimental to the ecosystem.
That is true. Yes, moderation.
Which is unfortunate.
Is FraserRiverSturgeon.com. Fraser. So if you,
I'll have to write that down.
You're looking for a really fun trip. Highly recommend it.
I know Dan just did one out of the Columbia River this last year too, and they had a blast up there. Awesome. I don't think they're as big as the ones you got. So that's pretty incredible.
It was a fun day. Even you know, Eve said it was a pretty big fish for the river. So I was pleased. It was fun.
That is cool.
Yeah.
Good memories made. So what other top trips or stories have you done? Like what are the top highlight ones? What off the top of your head?
Oh boy. Top highlight trips. I went deer hunting, harvested my very first deer in Hawaii. And Yes, I did. Growing up, we didn't do a ton of deer hunting with my dad. Personally, I think as a kid and even as an adult, I don't do well sitting down for a long period of time. I like to be up and moving. So sitting in a deer stand for 4 hours, I just count me out. I'll go stir crazy. So I didn't do a lot of deer hunting. I maybe only tagged along with my dad a couple times. So I decided that I was, you know, for me, for the show, we do a lot of wild game cooking, and I have been reading about Axis deer and how good it's one of the best wild game, you know, meats you can harvest, and that it tastes incredible. And so I decided that I wanted my first deer hunt to be something that I was really excited to eat. And I was going to Hawaii with Dan, and I booked a hunting trip on the island of Lanai with the Pineapple Brothers, and they're a guide service that was originally started, I think, like by Jack Carr and some other Navy SEALs. And Axis deer landed on the island of Lanai, and they're on Maui, and I'm sure they're on some of the other islands. They were a gift from the Emperor of Hong Kong in the late 1800s. And unfortunately, Axis deer, they don't have a single predator on the island, and there's not even a bird of prey on that island that will eat a dead carcass. So they have become an invasive species. And the hunting season there is year round, and Axis deer are very skittish. So they obviously, if they catch wind, if they hear you, see you, they are running. But what was so cool about it is you're hunting in this volcanic crater that was once, you know, obviously a volcano, and you're in this mass open space. And when you look out there with a blind eye, you're like, there's not any deer out here. And then you start glassing and you realize they're everywhere.
No kidding.
So you have to physically stalk them on foot. And you sometimes have to crawl on your belly and really get as close as you can. I was not, I was hunting with a rifle, I wasn't doing archery hunting. And that to me was part of the incredible experience of really being so instinctual and kind of going back to your ancestral roots of how meat really used to be harvested. I mean, crawling on your belly to sit up and do all the things. I decided that, you know, I was hunting for meat only, so I wasn't chasing trophy antlers or anything. So I harvested 2 doe. Cool. And it was an incredible experience. And for me, I wanted to make sure that I had the cleanest kill possible, because I didn't want cortisol hormone in the meat at all, or any of the stress hormones released if I could help it. And just because it was my first time, I wanted, just for me, of course, no one wants to wound an animal, right? So important to me. So I was successful on both of those, very instant. And also that, you know, it wasn't this moment of excitement that came over me. It was a moment of, you know, there's death there. Like you have to acknowledge death. And for some reason, us as humans have a different scale of how we feel about that, I think, based on the size of an animal at times. You know, with pheasants, you don't really feel that as much. If you kill a mouse in your house, you're like, whatever. But for some reason, if something's larger in size, there's this emotional effect around it. So I wasn't sad. I wasn't hyper excited. I was thankful. I was acknowledging that something died for me to eat, have food in my freezer. And we brought it. There's a butcher that lives on the island. His name's Bob the Butcher. And he was a trained culinary chef that used to live in France. And he said he smokes too much weed that he needed to live on an island.
So, at least he's honest, right?
Yeah. And his wife's from North Dakota, of all things. And they butcher Texas deer all day long. And he has such a technique that he butchers them with a machete. I mean, he has a very skilled technique at butchering your meat. And they process it. They ask you how much, you know, if you want ground access deer, if you want the steaks, whatever. And they vacuum seal it and deliver it right to the airport for you. So you go to the airport and they meet you at the airport, and there's your meat to go on the plane with you home. And so the whole experience was incredible. And access deer meat, venison, whatever you want to call it, is so good. You know, when you open up ground beef or ground venison, there is a scent to it. Like you either smell its scent, it's venison, or you can tell this is beef by smelling it. There literally was no smell. I opened it up. There's zero scent, which was also odd. I'm like, there's no smell of anything. I can't smell a thing. And that's how clean and mild the meat is. It's just super mild tasting. So you can, I mean, you can make anything with it and you won't have a single ounce of gamey taste to it at all.
I wonder if that's like, I wonder if that has anything to do with what region they're in. I wonder if that's the same with access to elsewhere.
That I don't know. That would be interesting. Cause you can, I mean, there's some big ranches in Texas and stuff that have access deer, but go do it in Hawaii. They're wild there. And it's, you know, you're helping the environment
and it's Hawaii. So good.
And it's white. That's why I'm like looking around this beautiful sunrise and it's like 65 degrees. And, you know, of course my hunting guide, Alec, who guides everybody out there. He's incredible. Grew up on the island and he's been hunting since he was a little boy and he was cold. It's 65. No, cause you know, for him,
yeah, I suppose he's used to it.
For him that was cold. And I was like, man, Alec, you've got the life out here. This hunting environment's incredible. So
it's kind of funny you say that. Just the other day, our guys in Texas were doing an event for Veterans Day and they had sent a picture out and they're all sitting around a table with winter jackets on. And I messaged them. I said, what's going on? They said, well, it got to 50. It was 80 earlier. Now it's 50. So we're all in our parkas. And I was like, oh man, I'm sorry.
Sure. Yeah. Don't come up here. Something changes with the blood in the system where you can get used to it or it feels really cold for sure.
My acclimation changes. So what is the more unique thing that you've done for Wild in the Kitchen, the show that you host with, you know, the wild game and whatnot?
I'm doing one tomorrow. Actually, that's kind of unique. I am cooking venison tagine, which is a Moroccan style of cooking. If you probably recognize the clay pot, it's kind of a round clay pot at the bottom, but then it comes to a smaller point at the top, and the top of the clay pot has it. Chef David Fima is a French Mediterranean chef locally, and I've known him for a lot of years. Good friend, great guy. And he is known for his tagines, and they're so, if you've not had tagine before, it is so good. It basically is like it's a way of slow cooking meat kind of in like a stew, if you will, because it all sits in this clay pot. So then it's served with bread and you can, you know, dip the bread in the juice or whatever, but we're going to do venison. And so that'll be a unique preparation. And we love to show people how to use wild game. My goal of doing Wild in the Kitchen when I pitched the idea of bringing cooking back to Minnesota Bound is that we're never going to use cream of mushroom soup or a crock pot. Just not going to do it. So
well, that's we want to show kind of a staple of the Midwest. So change it up a little bit.
Exactly. And that is an easy go-to. And definitely there's some recipes that taste great. But I wanted to show people that there are really like chef-driven ways to prepare wild game that are very easy and simple ingredients. That it shouldn't be intimidating. I want to show people how to brine their venison or pheasants or wild turkey for that matter, to prevent it from losing moisture in the meat and stuff like that. And there's really a lot of delicious ways to use wild game that are not intimidating. So that, but tomorrow should be a unique one. I'll let you know how it is.
Yeah, for sure. Do you have like a cookbook that you have put together or anything with all these different recipes that you do for that are available?
You can find all the recipes on Minnesota Bound webpage, which is mnbound.com. And there's a tab that's called Wild in the Kitchen, and all of them sit there. So some of the favorites of the feedback I've gotten, the pheasant egg rolls on Minnesota Bound web, on the Wild in the Kitchen page, very popular, very easy, very good. Also, there's a Thai coconut soup, which sounds, you're like, what? But it's used with walleye. That's really good.
Ooh, I'd try that.
Yeah. And it's easy to do. All these are like five ingredients and they don't take a long time. And it's not like, okay, first you have to, you know, do five steps and then 10 steps. It's really just pretty easy steps. We keep it simple on purpose, but all, a lot of them are really good.
No, it's cool. No, it's awesome. Yeah. So yeah. So I know we're getting 45 minutes here, but we'll, got a couple quick, other conversations to have, and then we'll get things wrapped up here. But like I mentioned before, Laura was our MC for our banquet last year, and that was a phenomenal night. And just want to talk about your experience with the banquet.
Oh yeah. Banquet was so fun. You know, I love what you guys are doing for people in need, from law enforcement, service members, EMTs, firefighters and things. You know, when people are in stressful situations every single day, and they're, like I said, your central nervous system can get really taxed just by having high levels of stress in your day every single day. And you don't understand that probably until you're in it. And to have outlets to offset some of that stuff is super important. And what I enjoyed the most at the banquet is the amount of enthusiastic support for your foundation, and hearing the stories of some of the veterans and law enforcement officers that have benefited from your excursions that you offer. So it was a really good night all around, but you know, you guys are obviously doing incredible work, and it was a fun to be invited to be a part of it for the night.
Yeah, and you were a great MC. I think the night flowed really well. You know, I think everything was balanced well, and with your interaction and commentary throughout the evening, I think it tied it all together very well. It was a fun night. Everyone had a good time, and people enjoyed meeting you. You know, it's like I said, I've been watching Minnesota Bound since I was a kid, you know, so it's kind of cool to have that transition up to you as a host and with Bill, and everyone be able to get to come say hi and meet you is pretty awesome. So I had a good time. And then really hopefully, this next year's March 25th will be our next banquet, and we're hoping to have Laura there again. So if you have not come to the banquet yet, something you definitely need to come experience.
For sure. So much fun. So much fun. You guys have a lot of fun, Gabe. I'm like, even the, you know, the auction items you're giving away and the amount of, you know, raffles, and the raffle prizes were incredible prizes. So, and there were so many of them given away that it is, you know, obviously you're supporting a great cause, and it's a fun event too. Sometimes charity events, they can feel like a very repetitive formula, if you will. And this one, it's different. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah. That was one of the things, like, we're trying to not make it bland and keep it engaging the whole night. So a part of that too is also with the people that we surround ourselves with and have there, you know, so it was very beneficial, and I really appreciate you coming that night. It was a good time. Well, so for our listeners too, you know, we are all over the country, you know, we're in 26 states. If individuals want to watch your show or listen to your podcast or even follow you on social media, how would they go about doing that?
Sure. My social media, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter are all at Laura Shera, and it's LauraschaRa is my last name. On Television Minnesota Bound, you can watch us on YouTube. All episodes are on YouTube at this point, and also Amazon Prime Video. For those that don't live here in Minnesota, you can find our television show there. And if you live here in Minnesota or the surrounding regions, we are on Care 11 NBC affiliate here in Minnesota. So going on 27 years of outdoor storytelling, there's a lot of episodes for you to catch up on.
Kidding.
Or 1,000, no, actually.
And you can't miss the introduction music. I mean, it's a staple. It catches you every time.
It does. It does. And, you know, be at 1,000 episodes, I didn't, you know, you kind of go through your day to day and you're filming and you don't realize the impact of hitting 1,000 episodes until we did our 1,000 episodes special. And there are only a few television shows that have made it to 1,000 episodes, including we are in the likes of Jeopardy, Wheel of Fortune, and Oprah. And here we are, this outdoor television show, regional television show, and we have hit as many episodes as those people.
That's incredible. And that's a huge feat.
It is a huge feat. And truly, you know, it takes a village. I have to, you know, you got to give shout outs to the photographers and the editors are a crucial part of making good television. And, of course, you know, everybody else that contributes from the sales team and everything else, but it takes a village to make quality TV shows. So it is a very big team effort. So I'm just excited to be a part of the team.
Yeah, and you guys got it honed in. I'm just getting my feet wet with our production crew. And I mean, I didn't realize how much there was to it until you actually jump into it. Looking for B-roll, you know, do you ever have enough B-roll? You can never have enough B-roll. That's one thing I've always learned. Getting the right audio and commentary at the right time, your voiceover work. I mean, just editing everything is just a lot. So you guys do a fantastic job. I love the show. I love that. You know, we're able to have this conversations with you guys. You guys are approachable. Game Fair is the number one place. I think that a lot of people get to come up and meet you and your father on an annual basis. Is there any other events that you have coming up soon that people can come say hi at?
Oh boy, I don't have any in the near future. A lot of them happen during summer, you know, summertime. So Game Fair, State Fair is a big one, Minnesota State Fair. Yes, if I see you guys at your event coming up in March, I would love, you know, I always love chatting with anybody who wants to talk about outdoor stories and such. So occasionally I pop up, I do some speaking engagements and things like that, but a lot of times those are just private corporations. So they're not really open to the public, but you know, I do post stuff. If I'm going to be somewhere, I'll post it up on my social pages. So that's typically
perfect
where you find it. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for all your support. You know, we saw you tagged us in this last Veterans Day on one of your posts. And then also we've been seeing some interaction, you know, other social media stuff. So I really appreciate the support you've given to HHO and being able to come to the banquet. Having us on your podcast was awesome. I think it turned out really well. Humble brag on my part. No joke.
You did a great job. It's a tough question.
I tried. Oh, man, it's just so much to talk about.
There is. Well, you guys just keep doing the good work that you do. We need people like you and very appreciative. And any way we can support, we're always happy to do so.
Yeah, keep telling your stories out there in Minnesota Bound. So we'll have to coordinate and get a show together with you whenever we can again.
Yes, for sure. We will get that done. Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you very much, everyone. If you have any questions, you guys are able to email info@hometownherooutdoors.org. And don't forget, if you're feeling like you are dark on times, having issues and need support from someone, you can reach out to us within our email, our Facebook or social media pages. Also, you can call 988, the Suicide Crisis Awareness Line. So until next time, we will see you out on the water and in the woods.
Thank you for listening to the Hometown Hero Outdoors Podcast. For more information about Hometown Hero Outdoors, visit our webpage at www.hometownherooutdoors.org.